Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, I'm Georgia and welcome back. Or if you're new here, welcome. On my platforms, I talk about unsolved true crime cases. I spread the word of missing and unidentified people, knowing that for so many cold cases, spreading the word as far as possible is the key to getting it solved. But today, I want to do something slightly different. I want to share with you the story of a very famous solved case that happened here in the UK. A solved case which, thanks to a grieving mother, would go on to change British law forever and undoubtedly save the lives of so many other children. This is the story of 8-year-old Sarah Payne. Sarah Evelyn Isabel Payne was born on the 13th of October 1991 to Michael and Sarah Payne. The couple already had two children, they had boys Luke and Lee, and they'd only recently got married when they fell pregnant with Sarah. She wasn't planned, but they were overjoyed nonetheless, and from the day Sarah was born, their lives changed forever. She was the first baby girl on Sarah's side of the family for a really long time, and Sarah really was this little girly girl. She loved everything dolls and fairies, dressing up in her mum's clothes and stealing her makeup. Her dad Michael called her his little princess. Sarah was a breath of fresh air in the family, described as a soft, gentle little girl with not a bad bone in her body. She was cheerful and smiley. Her older brother would later say in the Sarah Payne and Mother Story documentary that the now famous angelic photo of Sarah, the photo that was splashed all over the media in the aftermath of her disappearance, just encapsulated her fully. She really was that adorable little girl, that smiley face you see in that photo. If you're from the UK, you know the photo I'm talking about, her in her red school uniform. 3 years after Sarah was born, her younger sister Charlotte came along and the Payne family was complete. Two boys and two girls. Sarah and Charlotte were close as sisters, Charlotte copying everything her older sister did. They shared a bedroom and a joint love of the Spice Girls, singing and dancing to them constantly, even though Sarah would later joke that Sarah was always tone deaf, she had a terrible singing voice. The Payne family, with four children in total, was always crazy, late, disorganised. Being the oldest of four children myself, I know how that feels. It's just chaos all the time, trying to get everyone to where they need to be, loud and go, go, go all the time. But it's also full of love. And it seems like in all of that, Sarah's role in the family was that of care. She was always the one making sure that her siblings were safe and people were where they needed to be, making sure that everyone was okay all the time. Whilst researching this case, I cried a lot, and I'm really hoping I got my tears out in my research because I don't want to cry on this channel, but I really feel this affinity with her and I'm not really sure why. This is probably one of the earliest true crime cases I remember learning about as a child. I mean, living in the UK, I don't think you could avoid Sarah's case when it happened. It was splashed over the front page of every single newspaper. This was the leading story on every news programme. I would have been just 6 years old when Sarah disappeared, so I was just a couple of years younger than her, and I have memories of all this unfolding at the time. I don't think I can understate just how huge this case was in the British media. Everyone knew the name Sarah Payne, and everyone was looking out for her. On the weekend of Saturday the 1st of July 2000, the Payne family, who lived in Surrey themselves, decided to take a trip down to the coast to visit their paternal grandparents in Kingston Gorse, West Sussex, which is kind of smack bang in the middle of Littlehampton and Worthing. It was a family weekend, the grandkids being spoilt by their nanny and granddad, and on the afternoon of Sarah's disappearance, the family had taken a trip down to the beach. The kids were playing, being the kind of loud the kids can only be on the beach, just generally having a really nice time playing together. When Michael, Sarah and Terry, Michael's father, decided to move on from the beach, the kids wanted to stay and play a little bit longer, so the adults decided to walk on ahead to the village. Kingston Gorse is a tiny little place. The kids knew it really well and they knew their way back home or back to their grandparents' house. Plus, the older boys were basically teenagers at this point and more than capable of keeping an eye on their younger sisters. Luke was 12 and Lee was 13, I think. Sarah spoke to the kids and told Sarah to stick with her brothers, that they were in charge and to do whatever they said. Sarah said the last time she saw Sarah was when she turned back and waved, expecting to see her back at her grandparents' house very, very soon. They were literally like minutes, seconds away from their grandparents' house. And the kids did finish playing on the beach without incident, soon deciding to head back towards home and play in a cornfield that their grandparents' house backed onto instead. Whilst playing in the field, Sarah fell and scraped her knee and she got upset. She wanted to go back and see their nanny for comfort, who was still back at the house, but Luke tried to convince her to stay. She didn't want to though, she was an 8-year-old girl, she'd hurt her knee, she wanted her nanny, so started heading around the field to get back to the grandparents' house. And I cannot stress here how close they were, literally 30 seconds away, the house backed onto this field, they could see it. As Sarah headed back, Lee decided that he probably should follow her, and so he cut diagonally across the field in an effort to catch her up. He was literally 13 seconds behind her, that was it. But when he emerged out onto the road where Sarah would have reached just moments earlier, she was nowhere to be seen. She just completely vanished. She disappeared round the side of a hedge. By the time he came out the other side of the hedge, she was gone. 13 seconds was all this took. In a heartbreaking interview for the Mother's Story documentary, Luke says that his biggest regret in life is that he didn't hold on to Sarah, that he didn't just walk with her back to the house. He said he still has sleepless nights over it, wishing he could redo that day, he'd do anything to go back to that day and just walk with her. But you don't know what would have happened. Maybe Luke would have been taken as well. The children very quickly raised the alarm that Sarah had disappeared, just vanished into thin air. And after the adults searched themselves everywhere they could think of, Sarah called the police. She said that she was fairly calm up until that point, about as calm as any mother can be who can't find her child. But calling the police felt like she was admitting to herself that something was really wrong here. Within half an hour, the police were at the front door, and within just 1 hour, a full-scale police search was in effect. You had officers on foot, canines, helicopters, the full works. Hundreds of police officers from across Sussex headed to the Worthing coast to help with this search, and it continued all through the night. Sarah says that as darkness began to fall, she remembered Sarah was scared of the dark. She was terrified of her being out there, scared and on her own. Being just 8 years old, police knew from very early on that Sarah running away was incredibly unlikely. She had no reason to run away, she was a regular, happy, healthy 8-year-old girl who was on a trip to see her nanny and her granddad who she loved and didn't see all that often. She wouldn't have known this area very well, but she knew how to get back to her grandparents' house from this cornfield no problem. It was clear from early on that there was more going on here. Something had happened, something really, really bad. In those early hours, officers searched all of the adjacent fields as well as all of the cars in the vicinity in case she'd snuck into a car and got stuck, and all of the local houses as well. They knew that finding Sarah as quickly as possible was imperative. When children get abducted, as they quickly began to speculate in this case, 44% of them are killed within the first hour, 73% within the first 3 hours, and 99% within the first 24 hours. Alerts had to be raised as soon as possible if there was any hope of Sarah being found alive. A police officer sat with Sarah in the house all that first night, when around midnight the boys came down and said they had something to say. Upon reaching the road and noticing Sarah had disappeared, Lee said he'd seen a white van driving down the lane. The van did a U-turn, and as it drove back past, the driver waved and smiled at Lee before speeding away. He described the man as scruffy and dirty, like a mechanic who hadn't washed in weeks, with yellow teeth. In that moment, although Sarah's disappearance was already being treated as a possible abduction, it became very clear to investigators that Sarah had been in the back of that van, and finding the van along with finding Sarah became a top priority. Within just a couple of hours of Sarah being reported missing, they had 200 officers searching for her. But by Sunday, the next day, they had 500. By Tuesday, they had 1,000 officers on this case. That's one in three officers in Sussex searching for Sarah. They searched a massive 20 to 30 mile radius. If anything at all was found in that area by officers that looked like it might have belonged to a young girl, it was brought to Sarah Payne for identification to see if it belonged to Sarah. Nothing did, but Sarah said it was incredible how many items they found, how many children must drop or lose things, and you don't think about it until something like this. Just 3 years before Sarah's disappearance in 1997, the Sex Offenders Register had been put in place across the UK. The name of anyone cautioned or convicted for a sexual offence was placed on this list, accessible at this time to the police as a list of people to look at in unsolved sexually motivated crimes. What this register looks like has changed since 1997 and continues to change, but as of 2003, under the Sexual Offences Act, all those on the register must register with the police within 3 days of their conviction or release from prison. If you don't, you'll be charged with another criminal offence. Thank God this did exist in the year 2000, because after Sarah's disappearance, police very quickly took a look at this list and found there were only 6 men in the area on the Sex Offenders Register. One of these 6 men was a man called Roy Whiting. He was 41 years old, and police turned up at his door the day after Sarah's disappearance. And he became a person of interest here from very early on because of the nature of his earlier crimes. In March 1995, Whiting abducted a 9-year-old girl in Crawley, literally scooping her up from the street into his red Ford Sierra and threatened her to stay quiet with a knife. He took her to a wooded area where he sexually assaulted her, but she was ultimately allowed to leave the scene alive. A witness to the abduction said that the man responsible was driving a red Ford Sierra, and another man came forward saying that he knew a man called Roy Whiting who drove such a car. I can only assume that this acquaintance considered that Roy Whiting would be capable of such a thing to come forward, because this wasn't exactly a rare style of car at the time. Well, it would turn out that Whiting had sold this car shortly after the abduction. Undeterred, the police tracked down the car and forensic evidence proved this case. A knife was even found hidden in it. Whiting was arrested and charged with abduction and indecent assault. In June 1995, he pled guilty to the charges and was sentenced to 4 years in prison. Despite the maximum sentence for this crime being life imprisonment, he got off pretty light because A, he admitted to the crime early on, and B, a psychiatrist who assessed him deemed that he was not a paedophile. It was apparently a one-off event and he was unlikely to reoffend. Whiting was sentenced just 4 years in prison, of which he ended up serving just 2.5. This was despite a second assessment once he was in prison saying that he actually was highly likely to reoffend upon release. This was just a complete and utter failure of the justice system. But Whiting's name did become one of the very first on the Sex Offenders Register, and upon his release he decided not to go back to living in Crawley. Instead he ended up moving to Littlehampton, a seaside town full of children where in summer families descended upon the beach and villages in droves, where in July 2000 the Payne family decided to go and visit their grandparents. So as soon as investigators came across the name of Roy Whiting, convicted paedophile responsible for a very similar abduction living just miles from where Sarah disappeared, he became number one suspect. On the evening of the 2nd of July 2000, he was questioned for over an hour, in which he was deemed to have shown a distinct lack of concern over Sarah, which was a stark contrast to another sex offender they'd questioned earlier that day. Whiting just didn't care. One of the officers just had a very bad feeling about this guy. He said everything felt strange, everything felt off. So trusting his intuition, when they left, they didn't just drive away from Whiting's home. The officers waited around the corner and just watched, waiting whilst they debriefed. And as they did so, Whiting came out of his home and walked up to a white van parked nearby. This white van that clearly belonged to him. Whiting apparently searched around in the driver's footwell for a little bit and the officer's curiosity took over, so they walked back over to him and asked him what he was doing.
During this interaction, a receipt fell out of the van. As part of the questioning, the officers had asked Whiting where he'd been the previous evening, to which he said he'd been along the coast in Hove at a fun fair, which, you know, a convicted paedophile being at a fun fair just looks bad for him nonetheless. But this receipt that fell out of the van, which was dated for the previous evening, told a different story. It actually showed Whiting buying diesel at a Buck Barn petrol station located along the A24, which is northeast of Littlehampton and absolutely nowhere near Hove. In that moment, picking up this receipt, seeing the date and the time on it, he had clearly lied, and the police officers made a decision to arrest Whiting on suspicion of abduction. He was taken in for questioning and was held for 3 days, but he refused to cooperate, answering no comment to all questions posed to him. But despite this guy clearly being creepy and having enough to raise suspicions, they didn't have any actual evidence that he'd hurt Sarah, so he had to be released. Of course though, investigators did put a full surveillance team on him because they were terrified he was going to strike again. They knew that if this was the guy that they were looking for, then it was only a matter of time before he'd abduct a third child. Remember that all of this happened within days of Sarah's disappearance. Whiting was arrested the day after she disappeared. And in this time, the British media had already latched on to Sarah's case. Her name was at the forefront of every news show, on the front of every paper. Her parents, Sarah and Michael, did almost daily press conferences, talking to Sarah through the TV, telling her to be brave and that they were going to bring her home. These press conferences are heartbreaking to watch. The grief they feel is just palpable, but they were so strong. Sarah said she had to remain strong in case Sarah was watching the TV. Sarah had to know that Mummy was looking for her, and if Mummy wasn't scared, she didn't need to be either. Plus, Sarah had 3 other children and they couldn't see her scared either. I mean, I don't even have any children and I can't imagine being able to display the strength and dignity that Sarah and Michael did in the days following their daughter's abduction, under the media circus that descended down upon Littlehampton. And this wasn't just British media either. Countries from around the world sent satellite vans to cover this case. The level of coverage here was absolutely unprecedented. There wasn't a person in the UK who hadn't seen Sarah's beautiful, angelic school photo. Like I said, I was 6 years old and I remember this story vividly. The police investigation here was huge and they soon filmed a reconstruction to be televised in the hope that somebody would come forward with new information. Over a week after Sarah's disappearance, someone said they were sure they'd seen Sarah at Knutsford service station on the M6, which was hundreds of miles north, and thousands of hours of police investigation went into this, but it turned out to be false and it gave hope that she was alive. I don't know what's better or worse, giving the parents hope there's been a sighting and she might be alive, letting them think that for a little while longer, or having that hope and having it torn out from underneath them. It's unthinkable. There's no better, there's no worse, it's just awful. Around this time, Sarah and Michael had to be warned to expect the worst. Sarah was probably not coming home alive. Despite this, Sarah and Michael continued making their media appearances, giving everything they had to this investigation. Sarah wanted people, wanted the public to care about Sarah as much as she did. She wanted people to know her face, to search for her. And there's no denying that this worked. We all in the UK know Sarah's face. But sadly, 16 days after the disappearance, the naked body of a young girl was found 30 feet away from a main road in Pulborough, West Sussex, about 15 miles from where Sarah had disappeared. The body had been partially covered just off a footpath on the edge of a farmer's field. Everyone held their breath hoping this wasn't Sarah, but even if it wasn't, it would have still been heartbreaking. It was the body of a young girl. But of course, it was her. The lead investigators headed to the Payne's house to tell them, but Sarah knew what was about to happen. She delayed being told, saying that she wanted everyone together, but as she put it off, the news went live. Everyone else across the whole country found out at the same time as the Payne family that Sarah had died. Sarah said she was in denial at first, insisting she had to go and identify her daughter's body, otherwise it wasn't her. But the investigating officers persuaded her not to, saying that she didn't want to see her little girl like that. She would never recover from it. There was very little, if any, news coverage of the state of Sarah's body when she was found, but she was out there for probably 16 days, so I can't imagine it was nice. No mother wants to see that. In the end, with the permission of the Payne family, an officer was the one to positively identify the body as Sarah, something for which Sarah now says she's very grateful. Her last memory of her daughter isn't of her dead body. The post-mortem quickly confirmed that this was now a murder inquiry. Her cause of death was suspected to be strangulation, suffocation, or a combination of both. Sarah and Michael did one final press conference in the hope they could help find the killer, saying they hoped that no other family would ever go through this same thing. Meanwhile, investigators know, or they think they know, who was responsible. They just can't catch him. They actually really relied on the press coverage here to sort of spook Whiting, their main suspect, to make him do something stupid that was going to incriminate him. On the same day that Sarah's body was found, thanks to all this press coverage, a woman called the police, and she said that she'd seen a child shoe at Coolham Crossroads, about 8 miles from where the body had been discovered. This is a prime example of what I mean when I say even the smallest detail can help solve an entire case. This woman probably thought nothing of the shoe when she first saw it. Kids lose shoes all the time, but she had a feeling and she called it in. This shoe would turn out to be the smoking gun of this investigation. Officers went out to look for the shoe and eventually they did find it, child size 13, 150 metres from where it had first been spotted, now just lying in a field. They quickly confirmed with Sarah that this was indeed Sarah's shoe. Interestingly, the spot in which the shoe was found was on a direct route from the petrol station where Whiting had bought diesel on the evening of Sarah's disappearance to where her body had been found. The shoe was very quickly sent off for forensic testing, and as so many kids' shoes do have, the shoe luckily had a Velcro strap. Velcro is one of the most effective materials for capturing forensic material. It grabs and holds on to hundreds of things a day, fibres, bits of grass, hair. Velcro can create an entire story of your life, where you've been, what you've been up to. It can help solve your murder. At this point, Roy Whiting is brought in again for questioning, but he still refuses to answer any questions and he has to be let go again. At this point, with all eyes on him in Littlehampton, he'd actually already moved back in with his father in Crawley, but that didn't stop everyone watching him. He was feeling like a cornered animal. He could feel the police getting closer and closer, so he freaks out. One night, Whiting decides to go off and camp in a tent, which was actually very creepily near the spot where he'd taken his first victim. Still under surveillance, he steals a car, and as police try to stop him, he drives off at full speed, going the wrong way down the road, and a full speed chase ensues before he eventually crashes into another car. This was on the 21st of July 2000, so 3 weeks after Sarah disappeared, and he's arrested on a dangerous driving charge. And this was one of the best things that could have happened in this case. Investigators could now rest easy knowing that this man, who they were sure was responsible and was in any case a convicted paedophile, was now off the streets and back in custody whilst they finished their investigation. On the dangerous driving charge, Whiting was sentenced to 22 months in prison. In his panic, he just started acting completely recklessly. This was not a man who was a hardened criminal. This was a cornered man who started doing stupid things when he was about to get caught. He just didn't know how to act. He was always going to get caught for this crime. Investigators were sure that Whiting was their man, but you can't convict somebody on a feeling. It goes against the basis of our entire justice system. There has to be hard evidence, and if that evidence existed, investigators were going to find it. With Whiting now in prison, investigators now had access to his white van and his property. They could carry out all of the relevant forensic testing under no time constraints. They could really focus in on this. And with Whiting still not speaking, all they did have was forensic evidence. They had to find it. It seems that Whiting had the sense to steam clean the back of his van, but for some reason, he hadn't done the front. In the front of the van, Whiting had left one of his red sweatshirts, and on it they found a single long blonde strand of hair. This hair was found to have a 1 in a billion chance of not being Sarah's. And if that wasn't enough, 22 fibres from 5 different items found in the van matched fibres found on Sarah's shoe and in her hair. This was the missing piece of the puzzle. After this, it became very clear that Whiting was their man, and now they had irrefutable proof. On the 6th of February 2001, so 7 months now after Sarah's disappearance, Roy Whiting appeared at Lewis Crown Court, charged with the abduction and murder of Sarah Payne. But he hadn't just killed Sarah, he destroyed her entire family, changing the course of their lives. Sarah, Michael, Lee, Luke and Charlotte's lives, and so many other people's forever. Their lives would never be the same because of the choices, the actions of this one man, Roy Whiting. Of course, Whiting denied all the charges against him. He said he had no idea how Sarah's hair had got on his sweatshirt, and at his trial beginning on the 14th of November 2001, he pled not guilty to both charges. Sarah appeared in court every single day of the trial, but not once did Whiting look at her. He showed no remorse and no feeling. He refused to admit what he'd done. In somewhat of a controversial move, the judge made the decision that Whiting's previous conviction for abduction was to stay out of this trial. So the prosecutor really had his work cut out for him, trying to convince the jury that this was a dangerous man. This was an incredibly divisive decision. Some found it very hard to make peace with the fact that the jury wouldn't have this information, some deeming it just as important evidence as the rest. But it was also thought that if Whiting were convicted for Sarah's death, he could have argued that it was on the basis of this earlier crime and then it could have been overturned. So the decision stood. The jury were not to know that he was a convicted paedophile. Over the 19 days in court, several key witnesses took the stand, including Sarah's brother Lee, who described the scruffy looking man with yellow teeth that he'd seen driving the van that day, the man that had waved at him whilst he had his sister in the back. Now Lee hadn't picked out Whiting in the identity parade, but he was only young, he was a teenager, and he was deeply traumatised by what had happened. So this entire trial relied mostly on the forensic evidence, the hair, the shoe, which proved Sarah had been in his van. After 19 days and 9 hours of deliberation, on Wednesday the 12th of December 2001, the jury reached their decision. Roy Whiting was guilty of the murder of Sarah Payne. Judge Justice Curtis sentenced him to life in prison, saying that this was a rare case in which life really should mean life. He should never, ever be freed. Only at that point was his previous conviction read out in court. The public backlash to this news, both in court and now in the media, was intense, with the information that this was a repeat offender sparking calls for the government to allow controlled public access to the sex offenders register. What was the point of having such a register if the general public couldn't use it for their own safety? On the day after the conviction, the Home Office said that such a system would be unworkable, saying that it drove the risk of running sex offenders underground and making it more difficult for the police to track them. But how could it be that this man had been on the sexual offenders register? He was a known paedophile and had been set free to offend again, with his neighbours, local people being none the wiser as to his crimes. I mean, sure, the police checked in on him from time to time, but this just wasn't a great system. The sex offenders register is a great thing for the most part. I know there are criticisms of it, but I suppose this isn't the video to delve into those. Having the register meant the police turned up at Whiting's door the very next day after Sarah disappeared. But surely other people had the right to know who he was. Campaigning around this in connection with Sarah's case had actually begun in July 2000, the same month that Sarah died. It was spearheaded by the News of the World newspaper and they called it the For Sarah campaign. They were sure that this guy was going to have past convictions for child sexual offences, and they were right. With the backing of Sarah and Michael Payne, the News of the World wanted Sarah's Law, named after Sarah obviously, and Megan's Law, signed into action in 1997 over in the United States. 7-year-old Megan Kanker was assaulted and killed by Jesse Timondiquas, a known child molester that had two previous convictions for sexual assault. Without the knowledge of Megan's parents, he had moved into their neighbourhood. Megan's murder caused outrage across the USA, and her parents campaigned for a change in law to give parents access to information on child sexual offenders in their area. And in 1997, President Bill Clinton signed it into law. Why did we not have something like this in the UK? As I said, Sarah and Michael Payne backed the News of the World campaign from very early on, saying they were sure that Sarah's killer would turn out to be a previously convicted sex offender, and they were correct. The aim of the Sarah's Law campaign was for the government to allow controlled access to the sex offenders registry, so parents could know if a child sex offender lived in their area. Such a law may have saved Sarah's life. Sarah stood alongside the editor at the time, Rebecca Brooks, as they called on the government to change this law. It also called for paedophiles sentenced to life in prison to remain there until they died. When, after the trial, the government said they still had no plans to change the law, the paper adopted a policy of naming and shaming known sex offenders, which did lead to a number of paedophiles being attacked by members of the public and then going into hiding. Would this campaign be allowed to happen now? Probably not, but the early 2000s were a lawless time, and Sarah and Michael fully supported this. Apparently, the News of the World team would call them on a daily basis to see if they wanted to stop or withdraw their support, and they didn't want to. They were angry, and rightfully so. Although I can't help but feel that this did just back up the Home Office's view that having this information public would just lead to paedophiles going underground. They very much did do that. But when it came to Sarah's legacy, ultimately the newspaper and this campaign did make a positive change. In August 2008, a pilot scheme went out in four areas of England and Wales, where parents could inquire about a named individual who had regular access to their children, and if they were on the register, they would be told. In August 2010, the Home Office announced that after the successful pilot, the Child Sex Offender Disclosure Scheme would be extended to cover the whole of England and Wales. This allows parents to ask the police if somebody with regular access to their children has a record of sexual offences. It's called Sarah's Law. It's Sarah's and the Payne family's legacy. Despite the sheer strength displayed publicly by the Payne family in the aftermath of Sarah's disappearance, the family did really struggle. Michael Payne never recovered from his daughter's murder, and he would fall into a deep depression, turning to alcohol to help him through. It's said that he purchased a gun at one point during the trial with the intention of shooting Roy Whiting on the spot if he was found not guilty. He said he wouldn't live with this guy roaming the streets. He did end up handing the gun into the police, but this sort of encapsulates the mental state he was in. He wasn't okay. He just fell apart. His little princess was gone. In August 2003, Michael and Sarah separated, and in October 2014, he was sadly found dead in his home of an alcohol-related illness. Whiting doesn't only have Sarah's death on his hands, but Michael's too. Whereas Sarah focused all of her energy on campaigning for Sarah's Law, and in 2004 she published a book called Sarah Payne, A Mother's Story, about the murder and her campaign. In December 2008 she was awarded an MBE for her hard work in passing Sarah's Law before she suffered a stroke in December 2009. Luckily she ended up making a really good recovery and was able to continue with all her hard work. And then in July 2011, it was revealed that Sarah had been targeted in the News of the World's phone hacking scandal, which I will be doing a full episode on quite soon. Sarah refused to believe this. She'd been so close with the editor of the News of the World, Rebecca Brooks, and had always worked so closely with them. Why would they want to hack her phone? It would turn out that the hacked phone was actually given to her by Rebecca Brooks. It was a violation of trust and privacy, although Brooks has always denied any knowledge of any phone hacking that was taking place. Do we believe her? We'll see in the full episode. In June 2004, Roy Whiting appealed to the High Court for his life sentence to be reduced, and he was eventually heard in June 2010 at the High Court. They were now the ones to have the final say on when or if a life prisoner can be considered for parole. In 2002, a 50-year minimum sentence had been imposed on Whiting, but in 2010, this was reduced to 40 years, meaning that he will be eligible for parole in 2041 at 82 years old. Now, this is only when he's eligible. It does not mean that he will be granted parole at this point, and let's hope he never will be. This man is a danger to society. He should never be free to walk the streets where children walk alongside him. The justice system made that mistake once. I really hope they will not make that mistake again. If she was still alive, Sarah Payne would be turning 32 years old this year. Who knows what she could have done with her life if she'd had a successful career or kids, if her father would still be alive, if she'd travelled the world. Her whole life was stripped away for nothing. She would only be 32. She'd have so many years ahead of her still. But in her death, and with Sarah's law, who knows how many other children's lives have been saved. As I said, that is her legacy. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Please let me know if there's any other cases you'd like me to cover by leaving a comment down below, and I will see you in the next one. Bye, guys.